GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I am your host. So this week, I just want to tell you about something that's happening. I think this month of November has been the United Nations Climate Change Conference, or Conference of the Parties of the UNFCCC, more commonly known as COP27, is happening at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And climate change is the issue of our time. So make sure you look out for our episode on climate change, where we'll be discussing carbon trading. Is it applicable in Kenya? How would it work? And if you wanted to trade carbon credits, how would you do it? But today's episode, we want to talk about asset recovery as a tool against corruption. And our guest in studio is Philip Kagushia, the Deputy Director, Asset Recovery and Civil Litigation at the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. Welcome, Philip.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I want us to go straight into it and talk about the misconceptions and assumptions that we all have about the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission, EACC. What does the commission do and what is the mandate?
I like the word misconception because can you believe it, in this day and age where information is accessible at the tap of a button, many Kenyans still don't know what EACC does. So in a nutshell, the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission is a constitutional commission established under the Constitution, Article 79. And what is it supposed to do? It's supposed to do two things: combat and prevent corruption. So combating, obviously, sounds offensive. We know it's on the attack. It's combating, it's fighting corruption. But at the same time, prevention, because as we all know, prevention is better than cure. So we have those two mandates: to prevent and combat corruption. But how do we do this? We do this through law enforcement, public education, training, and creation of awareness. But when the Constitution came through in 2010, it gave us an additional mandate. And that's why, you know, before we were called the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission, now we're called the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. It means we were granted a bit more work, extra mandate to deal with ethics. So we also promote standards of conduct, especially for public officials.
Chapter 6 of the Constitution. Absolutely. Is your mandate, ensuring that our public officers are above board, that they adhere to the code of standards that we have set for them as representatives of us.
Absolutely. That's found at Article 80 of the Constitution.
And which institutions that EACC work with? You know, when I think about ethics and anti-corruption, and I think about the history of all of the iterations that EACC has had, I think about cases and going to court and scandals. What institutions do you work with?
Yeah, you're right. EACC has had quite a number of incarnations. But primarily, we work very closely with the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. And this is because EACC conducts investigations, makes recommendations, and these recommendations could vary. It could be to prosecute, recover assets which are lost through corruption. It could be to take no further action or maybe take some administrative action. But those recommendations by law have to be taken to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. And that's the closest partner that we have as EACC. So we make recommendations, file go to the DPP, and if the DPP concurs with our recommendations, then he charges.
Now, when you talk about investigation, there's a very aggressive mandate that the EACC has. What criteria do you use to determine that something is worth investigating or that something constitutes corruption and that now it should be investigated and then now presented to the DPP?
Aggressive, eh?
It's an implication. It's implied.
Well, you're right, because law enforcement agencies like the EACC have something called the coercive power of the law. So there's a bit of force. That's why it's called enforcement. But for anybody who's ever interacted with EACC, EACC is a very professional unit. You know, if you come there, I mean, God forbid, Jean, that you would visit me, God forbid. We conduct interviews. We don't interrogate people or grill people like the media likes to say. But about deciding which cases. So let me give you a bit of context here. We receive, say, 4,000 to 5,000 reports per year. Okay, that's a lot of reports. Even if you were able to do 10 investigations per day, you might not still finish because there's only 365 days in a year. Half of those reports tend to be outside our mandate. Some of them are like, you know, land disputes. You find somebody has been conned and he thinks it's corruption, but we have to explain that's a DCI matter, so we refer them to DCI, which is another agency that we work with. So out of those 2,000, because about half go away, so out of 4,000 to 5,000, about 2,000 remain with us. Again, it's still virtually impossible to investigate all those claims. So what do we do? Because we have a responsibility to the people of Kenya to act on them. So we came up with a strategy, a criteria for investigating these cases. And what we decided as a commission is we'll be focusing on high impact cases. And if you permit me, I'll define what high impact means.
Yes, I require that you define it so that we can understand as the public when you're investigating a case. So when a case comes out in the media, what criteria did you use to arrive at that particular case?
So you know, you want to do work that actually is felt by the country and by the citizens. So when we talk about high impact, one of the things that's really important is the value. What amount of money was involved? So let me simplify it. If I was to deploy investigators and lawyers and all the resources that I have to investigate a case worth 10 million shillings and the case is in Lamu, I would use the exact same resources to investigate a case worth 1 billion. So if I have a choice between the 10 million case and the 1 billion case,
you'll deploy all of your resources to the higher value case.
To the higher value. So automatically, because of the value, that case becomes a high priority case. The other thing that is quite interesting for us is the personalities involved. So again, you have a low-level accountant versus a CEO or an MD or a governor of a county. Again, whose profile is higher? So the profile is higher with the CEO, the MD, the governor. So that is also a consideration. Finally, there's the issue of public interest. There are certain cases that are very high, you know, in the minds of citizens. So cases to do with education, cases to do with health, cases to do with food security, you know, housing, things that are very close. You know, like right now, people are struggling because of cost of fuel, cost of unga, and so on and so forth. So again, what is the public interest? And if you allow me to give you an example, recently we had the High Court confirm a conviction of a sitting MP, and this is the MP, the CDC MP, John Waluke. If you go back to the genesis of that case, it was maize, mahindi, which we were, I think Kenya was struggling and we needed to top up our food reserves. And because of some fraudulent scheme, they pretended to supply maize worth 297 million. They never delivered anything and they still got paid. So if you think about that case, it has all the ingredients. So one, the value is quite high. It's 297 million. And mind you, Gene, that is 297 million in the year 2009.
So with interest, it's a multiplied.
And inflation and everything. So the value is high. What about the personality? This is a sitting MP. So
again, a serving public official who should be held to the standard of ethics.
Absolutely. And why is this a matter of public interest? Because we're trying to deal with food security. So it becomes a matter of public interest. So that's a perfect example of a case which falls within our high impact criteria.
And I'd like to take you back a little bit. You spoke about a reporting mechanism so that you get a number of reports, about 5,000, you said, which then you analyze and come down to about 2,000, which you now determine which ones fall within your criteria, then you choose. That implies that I can report. Is there a mechanism through which any person can report and who can report an issue to you?
Yeah, so the most straightforward way of reporting is just walking into any of our offices. So our headquarters is at Integrity Center on Valley Road. Okay, it's actually right between the junction of Valley Road and Jakaya Kikwete. So you can walk in and make your report.
The Golden Building.
The Golden Building, yes. And on top of that, because we are trying to also abide by the constitution in terms of devolving services across the country, EACC has 11 regional offices. So we're not represented in every county, but we are in 11 regions. So, for example, I spent 5 years in Mombasa, and at the time I was serving 6 counties. And then we opened up an office in Malindi. So we have upper coast and lower coast, Mombasa and Malindi. If you're moving from east to west, I think the next nearest office is Garissa, then Machakos, then Nyeri, then Isiolo, then Nakuru, then Eldoret, Kisumu, Bungoma, Kisii. I don't think I've left anyone.
Any region
else. Yeah. So those are 11 regional offices and they all serve more than one county. So for example, the Garissa office was serving Garissa, Wajir and Mandera. So you could also walk in. But on top of that, we are also represented in all the Huduma centers found in all counties. So there's approximately 50 Huduma desks which you can report to EACC. So that's the walk-in and that's like the very basic mode of reporting. You walk in and you make your report. However, nothing stops you from writing. You could write a letter and send it. You could do an email, you know, pick up the phone, call EACC and tell EACC, I think Gene is up to something. You could text. Have I mentioned email?
Yes.
But using technology, because EACC has a website, www.eacc.go.ke, you could go to the website. There's a portal for reporting, and in that portal, you could actually report anonymously. And allow me to emphasize, it is possible to report anonymously, and there's a very good reason for that. A number of people are in sensitive positions, and they want to make a report. they don't want their identity to be revealed because sometimes there's retribution. And I know you'll want to talk to me about that a bit later.
Yes, I would. I'd like to talk to you about whistleblowers. But now that you brought it here, let's discuss it here. One of the persons who present themselves to report are whistleblowers. So these are people in positions of authority, in positions where they have access to sensitive information. And out of, I don't know whether it's their conscience, they see certain activities happening that they feel should be acted on. So what mechanisms do you have? One, you said that we can report anonymously, but what other mechanisms do you have to protect whistleblowers or to enable them, especially if they're in really, really high positions, present their evidence or submit? Is there anything they're meant to give you or any way that they can access you?
Jean, let me start by saying Kenya doesn't have a great history with whistleblowers.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you remember, was it the Golden Bug
yes.
scandal where a gentleman by the name of Munyakei
yes,
was the one yeah, who blew the whistle on that, and it didn't end well at
even,
all.
Even with John Kivongo and Anglo Leasing, I don't think in the end, when you look at the balance of it, he really would have rather kept quiet. So how does that work?
Maybe not. So we don't have a comprehensive legal framework for the protection of whistleblowers. And my understanding is that there is a whistleblower protection bill that's been doing the rounds in parliament for the last, I don't know, 8-9 years. So maybe that's something we need to think about, especially because we have a new parliament, and we probably, maybe that's one of the things we need to revive. Let's have the whistleblower protection bill passed into an act of law. But all is not lost, because in 2016, we enacted a bribery act, which borrowed heavily from the UK Bribery Act of 2006. And one of the provisions in the Bribery Act of Kenya 2016 is there is some protection for people who report bribery and other forms of corruption. So at least to some small degree, there's some protection, but the truth of the matter is in more developed jurisdictions, there is a comprehensive whistleblower protection mechanism, because we don't want this person to be punished, to be victimized, because you can be transferred, you could be demoted, you could be fired. There could be all sorts of things.
And there are also implications on your family. So even as you make the decision, I think most people sitting there think about even other their dependents and how that the impact that will have on them losing their job or them being in a position where they are a victim of attack or some sort of retribution.
And you know, these are very real considerations. You know, sometimes people talk about corruption as if it's a theoretical thing up in there, like an abstract concept. But the truth is, it's involving human beings. So if an ordinary Kenyan citizen has to make a choice between feeding his family and reporting, he might not have the courage or the, you know.
You just think back about your family and how that will impact them, and you just
you
say,
have
you know
dependence
what?
And
I'll close my eyes.
And this is even beyond your own personal safety. It's important to discuss corruption in the context of real life human situations.
Well, whenever I think about EACC, I think about the freezing of assets and the seizing of accounts. And but what is the difference between what EACC does and the assets that you do seize and what the Asset Recovery Agency does?
The reason you think about that is perhaps because of your own legal background. I think when other people think about EACC, they think about grilling. They really like that word, grilling people, right?
That's true. I think the media is to blame for that thought.
Yes. So let me just explain the whole point of the freezing and then talk about the Asset Recovery Agency. So in the course of an investigation, as I said, we receive thousands of reports, and they're prioritized based on the criteria that we just spoke about. If someone stole, say, 100 million shillings and he's stashed it in a bank account, you may not want to investigate, because investigations take time. If an investigation takes, say, 90 days, the money might have moved. So
in fact, they would intentionally move the money. The moment you just raise the flag and say that I'm investigating you, it'll be my business to hide everything that I've acquired illegally.
And that's why I use the example of cash, because cash will be moved immediately. You know, you go on your computer and you do your mobile banking, online banking, whatever it is, and the money moves immediately. So you might want to get court orders. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand, you know, we don't do it arbitrarily. We have to go before a judge and justify and explain that there is reasonable suspicion of corruption because this person has been doing X, Y, Z. Okay? He has been doing a number of things which we believe constitute corruption. But before we conclude investigations and decide what to do, can you please preserve these assets? So the assets are usually cash, landed property. So you'll find huge parcels of land, farms, plots, apartments, and vehicles. More recently, we are seeing other things like policies, insurance policies, fixed deposit accounts. I don't know if we have anything to do with crypto, but for sure, you know,
it's a good place to hide money.
Yes, as night follows day, there will be cases like that. So we ask the court to hold on to that asset for a period of 6 months, as we conclude investigations. And then when we conclude investigations, depending on what the investigations reveal or establish, then we decide what we're going to do next, because the next is probably asking for forfeiture or for recovery. About the Asset Recovery Agency. The Asset Recovery Agency is established under a different law. It's known as the Proceeds of Crime and Anti-Money Laundering Act 2009. And their mandate is to recover the proceeds of all crime. So Asset Recovery Agency, ARA, can pursue confiscation of, say, drug money or money from human trafficking or from poaching or even from a bank robbery. Okay? So their mandate is much wider. It's all crime, including corruption. And I think it's important to mention that. So their mandate is much wider than EACC. EACC is a specially designated institution, and our mandate is limited to corruption. So the only crime we're dealing with is corruption. So we recover proceeds of corruption. ARA recovers proceeds of all crime. Yes.
Even small crimes, like what you'd call a small crime, like an accountant in a particular institution fleecing money from that particular institution, that is a crime, and the Pukamla would allow ARA to be able to recover that money.
Absolutely. And mind you, that small crime being perpetrated by thousands of accountants becomes a big crime.
That's true.
Yeah.
ESCC has instituted in collaboration with the DPP cases for the compensation and recovery of corruptly acquired and unexplained assets. Tell us some of your success stories.
Okay, so I just like to clarify, when the DPP is able to recover assets, it's usually after a conviction, because the DPP's mandate, again, under the Constitution, is prosecution. And there's one or two cases where I've seen the DPP do a commendable job, because at the end of the prosecution and when they secure conviction, they're able to ask for orders for what was lost to be restored to the state. That's known as conviction-based asset forfeiture. Interesting case is the one involving the Youth Enterprise Development Fund. I don't know if you remember this case, Jean, where it was so strange. Quite a number of people died before the case was prosecuted. So you'd have the chairman of the board, he died before he was prosecuted. The CEO of the Youth Enterprise Development Fund also passed away. So unfortunately, only the contractor was prosecuted and convicted. And because the sum involved was 180 million, he was imprisoned, fined, and ordered to return the 180 million. So that's a very good example of a case where the DPP has been able to return funds. But for the most part, EACC initiates civil matters for recovery. And these are completely independent. And our civil matters for recovery are usually of two types. There are those ones I would call kienyeji. You know, they're pretty straightforward, because you can see what the public officials did wrong. Maybe they flouted procurement procedures, or they didn't follow the Public Finance Management Act. And they did something wrong and they caused their institutions to lose money, or they abused their positions to gain money for themselves. So that is the money that we go after, and that's usually straightforward. But more recently, Gene, what we've been doing, which is cutting edge, is the forfeiture of unexplained wealth. And this is a simple case where I look at Gene and I say, there is no way this young lady should be having $1 million in her account, because we know what she does for a living. We know her legitimate sources of income, because you know, you have a salary, you have a pay slip, and if you're a public official, you're also
required, in fact you're mandated, to explain your assets. Submit wealth declaration form.
Yes. Full definition of that form is declaration of income, assets and liabilities. So every 2 years you should be making that declaration. So we have what you'd refer to as a baseline. We have a foundation for establishing that. Anything else you have is a disproportion. Now the question is, how did you acquire it? And if we demonstrate that there's reasonable suspicion of corruption, we now invite you to explain yourself. And what EACC does is that the EACC CEO will write you a letter under Section 26 of the Anti-Corruption and Economic Crimes Act and say, look, we know this is how much you earn. We know these are your legitimate assets, yet you have $1 million in your account. We don't understand this disproportion. Can you please explain? And if your explanation is not satisfactory, we go to court and we tell the court that we've done this investigation, we have established the assets, we have established the disproportion, we suspect corruption, and this person has not explained satisfactorily. We would like you, the court, to declare that these assets are unexplained and they should be forfeited to the state. So again, it's not arbitrary.
Yes.
We follow the rule of law.
And in fact, I think that you said this before, that if you have an asset that you can explain away, so like for instance, I have a rich relative who I had no idea about and I received an inheritance.
A Belgian, perhaps?
Perhaps they were Belgian.
So like those college girls who were receiving, I think, €1 million apiece.
Yes.
That's a perfect example of a case where it's difficult for these girls to explain the legitimate source of this money. And it's likely to be proceeds of crime.
And of course, for that one, they would forfeit the asset.
Yes, that is what will happen. But again, that falls under the Asset Recovery Agency because we don't know what crime is involved. It might not be corruption. But ideally, that money should be forfeited because we suspect it's proceeds of crime.
And what are the biggest fines that have been paid out on any of the cases that you have done?
The biggest fines have not been paid out. They are too big. off the top of my head, there's the Youth Enterprise Fund. And the reason the fine became big was because of several counts. You know, when there's a charge sheet, then there's a number of offenses, and the offenses have several counts, count one, count two, count three. That tends to have a multiplier effect on the fine. So that was quite high because I think it was over 700 million. Remember, I told you only one person ended up being charged.
The strange case.
Yeah, the weird case, yeah. Only one person ended up being charged. So when there's a multiplier effect, and the reason there's a multiplier effect is because of the number of counts. But the other reason why there's a multiplier effect is because the way the law is structured, it says that upon conviction, there should be an additional mandatory fine, which is up to 2 times the value of the loss that you occasioned or the value of what you gained. So this guy, because he occasioned the loss of 180 million, if that's doubled, that's 360 M. But that's not the highest. The next one, which is close, is the Sirisi MP matter, John Waluke and the other lady called Wakungu. In their case, because what was lost was 297 million, there were counts where it was being doubled. So 297 times 2 is 594. So if you do that in one count and then in another count, then the fine approaches a billion. Okay, so that's quite high. Well, you will believe this, Jean, that's still not the highest fine. The highest fine is in the NSSF case. Involving Discount Securities Limited. And because what was lost was 1.2B, in some counts it was being doubled, so that was going up to 2.4B. And I think by the last media reports I saw on the aggregate amount of fines was 9.6, 9.8B.
Yeah.
So that's the highest.
9.8 billion.
Yes.
But also that case, that I felt like the NSSF case met the criteria very, very much, because this is money that is being taken from people who have been saving. They're clueless about what was happening to their money. And at the moment when they needed it, it would be gone. So I felt like there was a need to be very punitive in that case, that you could teach a lesson and there'd be some deterrence from any other agency that has a sort of mandate of protecting government assets to ensure that that does not happen again.
How many people will have suffered from losing their pension because of that 1.2B? And mind you, you know, for a public servant like myself, I'm contributing towards my pension. So in a number of years, I'll be retiring, and then somebody tells me that my money is lost and it's lost through corruption. You know, why should I not be aggrieved? And why shouldn't Kenyans be aggrieved? And there's an element of investigations and prosecution and asset recovery, which is intended to be punitive because it serves as a deterrent. Yeah, so it really needs to send a message across that crime does not pay.
I agree with you. Have there been any challenges? What challenges has EACC faced in executing its mandate?
All right, so I look at the process of fighting corruption as a very, very long journey, because if you go back into history, you'll see the evolution of the institution that we have today. In 97, it was called the Kenya Anti-Corruption Authority. Then something happened and it was no longer there. Then there was a Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. Then the new constitution came in 2010 and it became the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. And then, you know, baby steps. When I joined the EACC 12 years ago, we were barely managing a couple of convictions per year. But the last data that I looked at, we are doing about 50 convictions per year. So that's about a conviction per week. And the nature of the convictions and the people involved is also changing. You know, previously it would be maybe what you'd call a low-level public official, but because of the new strategy that has been adopted by the current administration, we're looking at high impact cases. That's why you'll see, for instance, like right now, there's about 9 governors in court and their cases are ongoing. We have heads of parastatals, we have cabinet secretaries, we have permanent secretaries. So one of the challenges is that evolution, because things happen and there's a change, so you need to start afresh. But because it's a journey, what we need to do is just, again, put things into context. You know that you're going to spend time in court. The judiciary maybe doesn't have the capacity to hear all your cases. So that's a challenge. And if your case is taking 10 years, like the Waluka case, I think it started the investigation in 2009. They were convicted in 2020 in the magistrate's court. So that's maybe 11 years, right? What do you think happens in the middle? Do you still have your witnesses? Maybe not. Do you still have all the documents?
Maybe not.
Even if you have the witnesses, there's witness fatigue because they've been told come to court every other month. They're in court and they're traveling. Maybe they're not always in Nairobi. Maybe they've already retired and they're up country. So you're calling somebody, say, from Taita Taveta. You're calling somebody from Turkana, you know, from Wajir, and you're asking these people to come in and testify. So there's witness fatigue, and that takes time. There are those kind of challenges. And then there's a capacity issue. How many people are investigating? Kenya has a population of, depending on who you ask, about 50 million. EACC has a total staff complement of 800, and that's including support. I mean, how many cases
could you possibly investigate?
Could you possibly investigate?
With the limitations of time and human fatigue.
Yeah. And you know, when I was mentioning the documents, whether the documents are still available, do you know how many counties have actually burned their offices to destroy evidence? I don't know which county you come from, but I know for a fact Kitui has gone up in flames, Garissa has gone up in flames, Migori has gone up in flames. There's quite a number. These are challenges. So you end up having a case in court, but you don't have the original documents because they've been destroyed. And there's a more recent phenomenon, which is, it's insidious. It's a terrible thing because this is the politicization. When EACC, you know, conducts investigations and makes recommendations and even institutes civil matters for recovery, we are guided by the rule of law. And that's why we have criteria which I can be transparent about and say we have high impact cases, we look at the value, we look at the personality and the public interest. We don't care about the politics or the person involved. But the moment we get, that's when we discover which political party he belongs to. Or the moment we apprehend Jean, that's when we discover which ethnic community she hails from. We didn't know before, we did not care. But because corruption fights back, and this is the truth, it's a fact that you have to accept. And mind you, if you were drowning, you would clutch at straws, right?
That is true.
A drowning man clutches at straws. You will find anything to fight back. So it's possible for you to start saying, hang on, it's my community which is being attacked. Or hang on, I'm only being attacked because I'm of this political inclination. And that's a very irresponsible thing to do. Because sometimes it does appear that a lie, you know, I've heard this saying that a lie goes around the world 3 times before the truth
even has a chance to get out of bed.
Yeah. So, and that really affects us, because if that is a narrative that goes out and then it becomes a popular narrative, then it's difficult to claw back. Yes, what are you trying to do? We have very professional investigators and lawyers and so on and so forth trying to do an honest day's job. They are not leaving, they go back home to their families, yet they are being told that they're only doing this because of politics. And that's not nice.
I think also one of the challenges of high-impact cases with serious personalities is that they all have a voice. They have a critical mass that already subscribes to the whatever they've been saying. So once you flag them, they're then able to weaponize that critical mass against you and against the charge, regardless of its veracity. Yeah. Now, I'll ask you my last question. The Constitution of Kenya 2010 provides for the use of alternative forms of dispute resolution to enhance the delivery of justice. What ADR mechanisms does EACC use in executing its mandate?
Yeah, so I think if you go to the Constitution, I think it's Article 240 something, maybe 248 or 252. It says that constitutional commissions like EACC are empowered to engage in alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. But for EACC, and because of EACC's unique mandate, the only thing we can do is negotiation. Because, you know, for alternative dispute resolution, ADR, you have the arbitration, conciliation, mediation, negotiation. But for EACC, the only thing we can engage in right now is negotiation because of our enforcement mandate. We might find ourselves in an arbitration because we have a contractual dispute with someone, but what we can initiate is negotiation. Let's say Jean finds herself in a mess. You know, maybe she signed off on something. You know, maybe you are the chief accountant and you are told sign off on this, or you are the head of supply chain and you're told sign off on this, and you know, the problem with evidence, you know, we don't deal with conjecture, we deal with evidence.
Yes.
The evidence is that Gene signed off and there's a loss. And let's say the loss is 10 million shillings. And, you know, there's a risk you're going to be charged.
Yes.
And we're going to file a civil case for recovery. You'll lose your job. You're still young. You're in your career. And it was an honest mistake. There's no reason why you can't approach EACC and say, look, I messed up. I signed. I should have paid more attention. But because this money is lost, and sometimes you're not even the beneficiary of the money. You know, it's not like you signed and then
you got a kickback.
You didn't get anything out of it. And you say, okay, I'm prepared. I will sell one of my properties. I will refund this 10 million. And EACC can consider whether to forbear recommending prosecution and can forbear, well, there's no longer any need to institute the recovery suit. So that's what we do. We do negotiation and we're able to resolve quite a number of cases. And in fact, did you go to the Nairobi University?
No,
the University of Nairobi.
No, I went to Moi University. I was in the hinterland.
You know, I'm from Rift Valley myself, so I'm quite familiar with Moi. But for those of our listeners who went to the University of Nairobi, that parcel of land which we recovered on Galana Road, it's about 5 acres and valued at 2 billion. It was resolved. That recovery was settled through negotiation. So the guy just decided, okay, I'm prepared to surrender this. EACC has done investigation. It has established that how this property was acquired. It was acquired irregularly. Instead of fighting it in court for another 5-10 years, let me surrender. And the ADR mechanism is alive and kicking, and it's guided by a policy. So again, it's not arbitrary.
And then finally, now that you're able to negotiate, are one of the things that you can negotiate on plea bargains, if now I have been brought, in fact, I don't claim myself, just in case the devil is hearing, but in case a person is brought before you and they'd like to negotiate the plea that they have, is that an option that's available?
Yes, it's an option, but the first thing you have to bear in mind is that the responsibility for prosecution is the DPP. So that conversation cannot be had without involving the DPP. So the DPP has to be at the table because the ultimate decision about whether to charge lies with the DPP. So you'd have the DPP there. You'd have EACC because EACC investigated and established the facts. And then we'd have the subject of the investigation. And you know, he or she will be able to say, okay, yes, all these things happened. But for instance, I know if I'm prosecuted, I might be imprisoned for 5 years. Okay, can I plead guilty and serve 6 months? Okay, can I return the money as well? So this is a conversation that can be had. And if all parties are in agreement, again, there is a guideline. I know the DPP's office has guidelines on these things. It has prosecution guidelines. I'm pretty sure it speaks on plea agreements. Then the case can be settled. It can be settled in that way. And mind you, I keep referring to developed jurisdictions. If you go to those countries where they seem to be more developed than we are, part of the reason their law enforcement agencies are so successful is because they conclude a lot of matters by way of plea agreements, plea bargain. So if in Kenya, for example, our conviction rates are about 63% corruption cases, right? You might find in America it's maybe 90%. And the reason it's 90% is because a huge chunk of those cases are settled by way of plea agreement.
Now, I have one final question, and that's on the role of lawyers
yes.
in corruption and money laundering. Can we touch on that, seeing as I am in Gikera and Wetkama Advocates, we are a law firm, a very above board law firm, I'd like to state. But what role do lawyers play?
Yes, our beloved profession. So, I can give you in the context of maybe a typical scenario. Why do people engage in corruption? They engage in corruption to make money. But now that they find themselves, you know, with all this cash, but they don't know what to do with it, or they know what to do with it, but they need it done well. So, for instance, if you want to buy an apartment right here in Westlands, you'll need an advocate, you'll need a law firm to do the conveyance for you. So you transmit the money to the law firm's client's account. Now, the huge risk for our profession is this. You as the advocate may or may not know that this money is the proceeds of crime. It could be any crime. And the problem is, if your firm is used as a conduit for proceeds of crime, you might find yourself as a co-accused with the person who actually committed the corruption, because, you know, it may be said that if you had done your due diligence, you should have been able to detect that this money is proceeds of crime. So the law firms do play that role, and there are quite a number of cases where you see somebody has stolen a lot of money and then use that money to buy apartments, to buy farms, to do all sorts of transactions, and those transactions are conducted by law firms. And I think there's actually a precedent, which was a decision of Justice, the late Justice Onguto. It involves a law firm, and in that case, the main takeaway is that under Kenyan law, money laundering is a standalone offense. So we don't need to secure a conviction on the predicate offense. We don't need to secure a conviction on fraud or embezzlement or abuse of office, money laundering by itself. And this involved a law firm. So that is a genuine risk. And to the wider context, Kenya is attempting to match the standards of developed countries in terms of mechanisms to prevent money laundering. And nowadays they talk about money laundering and counter-financing terrorism, okay, because these things go hand in hand. Because we're not doing so great, our ranking internationally has gone down. In fact, we've been recently downgraded under the Eastern and Southern African Anti-Money Laundering Group. So we're not doing great. And then there's a ripple effect that we don't think about. Somebody who's coming to Kenya to invest, and they've come from a jurisdiction whose systems are at a high level, will be thinking, that's like the wild, wild west. Why am I taking my money to a country where there's no mechanisms to prevent either money laundering or the prevention of terrorism? So these things, they do have a ripple effect. And I think our profession has a huge role to play. Maybe it's something that we need to come to a table and agree, because, of course, there are reservations. Lawyers also are in this business to make money. And maybe they feel you're asking them to do too much homework in terms of due diligence. But certainly there's a risk for our profession that you may be handling proceeds of crime.
Thank you for that. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at our book of the week. Welcome back. After a short break, we're looking at our book of the week, and our book of the week this week is The Republic of Gupta. If there's a word that was the word of the election during the campaign period for the 2022 general election, that word would be state capture. And our book this week, The Republic of Gupta, A Story of State Capture by Pieter Louise Myburgh, investigates such a scenario in South Africa. Investigative journalist Pieter Louise Myburgh pieces together the jagged pieces of the history of Atul Gupta's remarkable rise from a flea market shoe seller to being listed as the seventh richest person in South Africa, and exposes the biggest official heist by private interests in the South African state. Having immigrated from India to South Africa, three brothers, AJ, Atul, and Rajesh Gupta, had been quietly building an empire across the country. And when the Guptas arrived in South Africa in 1993, they encountered a country in a state of a hopeful transition. So using their business skills that they'd honed in India and Singapore, the Guptas worked their way into South Africa's inner circle of business and political elites. At its height, the Gupta Empire had interests in uranium deposits, media outlets, computer companies, coal mining, and arms supplies. AJ was the family patriarch and the political brain of the operation. And Atul, he oversaw the outreach to corrupt government officials, while Rajesh was the business negotiator. The Guptas supported Jacob Zuma before anyone thought he could be president. And when he did become president, the Guptas began to plunder the South African government at an unprecedented scale. The story of the Gupta brothers offers a case study in what is known as state capture, described by one writer as a modern-day coup d'etat waged with bribery instead of bullets. State capture goes beyond paying off greedy officials. It's about distorting government policy for personal gain. And in fact, in April 2010, the state-owned Industrial Development Corporation lent the Guptas $34 million, which they used to buy a uranium mine. And one government official said that the Guptas had offered him the position of finance minister. Now, the three Gupta brothers had effectively seized control of all state apparatus. They could wield the money, they could hire fire. And their capture would have continued unchecked and unknown by the public, were it not for one mistake: an extravagant wedding and a curious radio reporter. This was an interesting read, which I highly recommend. I'd like to ask my guest one question. Could state capture at the level of the Guptas happen in Kenya?
That's a very interesting book and a very interesting question. So we are always susceptible to corruption. We need to look at corruption as a very complex thing that is dealing with human beings, right? The other thing that you probably might need to understand is that different types of government are exposed to different types of corruption. So if you find a country that's an autocracy, it's exposed to a very different type of corruption. If you find, say, a monarchy, they have different types of corruption. And for democracies like South Africa, depending on the level of democracy, so a very advanced democracy like in the West will have a different type of corruption, whereas a developing democracy like ours here, a different type of corruption. So we are always susceptible, we are always at risk, and for sure it could happen, and it probably will not happen because of the efforts of the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission.
And I like that. That brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Philip Kagushia, the Deputy Director, Asset Recovery and Civil Litigation at the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I am your host, Jean Kambuni. I'm sure you noted that we changed the format of our podcast. Going forward, the GVA Legal Podcast will have three segments. Our first segment will look at what happened this week in the law. The second segment will be our usual interview with our in-studio guest. And the third segment is a book of the week. In this segment, we'll give a summary review of a recommended book of the week. Tell us what you think about our new format in the comments section of our social media pages or on our email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Bagama Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast.